So let me mention my collaborators. So first, Philip Sharp. Dr. Sharp is a professor of applied mathematics and computational mathematics at the University of Auckland. And much of the work that I'll report here, the computational part, which is what's especially relevant to you, is the LA Computer Society, was performed on a supercomputer facility at the University of Auckland. Actually, it's an IBM Roadrunner with 20,000 processors. So we make good use of them. And my more local collaborator, Bruce Bills, from the Jet Propulsion Lab. Let me give you a bit of an introduction while following. I do want to spend a minute focusing on this panel at the bottom of the screen. And beginning on the left, you have the Sun. You see Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, and then a big jump, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And the relative sizes of the planets is fairly accurate. So you see that we are, in fact, very puny in contrast, say, with Jupiter, which has a mass over 300 times that of us, Saturn nearly 100 times greater, Uranus and Neptune 14 and 17 times greater. So it should be evident that the actions of these bodies, especially upon using thinking in terms of its gravitational influence on materials in the outer solar system, and we think of comets, asteroids, reside between Mars and Jupiter, but likely a planet that was unable to form because of the disruption caused by Jupiter's gravitational pull. But the giant planets have a governing influence on what happens in the outer solar system. So whenever you see a comet, and comets are relatively rare to be observed, but whenever you see a meteor shower, you're looking at the detritus left behind from comets that have lost material due to close approaches to the Sun, where the ice that formed the glue that bonded together materials basically sublimated, literally vaporized. So we have two senses of size scale here, the tiny size of the terrestrial planets, but the massive scale of our solar system. And one unit that I'll refer to in passing it's a reflection of our anthropomorphic tendency. When we like to think about our distance from the Sun, we give it an exalted name. We call it an astronomical unit. And so we refer to Jupiter's distance from the Sun as 5.2 times that, Saturn is around 8 times that, etc. So let me turn now to the focus. And in some sense, I want to blend together a number of themes, embracing some issues that have existential import relating to the emergence of life and continuation of life and our potential, the risk that we face. And so the history of life has been punctuated by large numbers of extinction events. In fact, the formation of our planet was extraordinarily chaotic and disrupted in the first half billion years of its formation because of such impacts. And I refer to, in this slide, I refer to it as the ultimate in cold case investigations. Usually in a criminal context, you like looking at evidence. And you like to think of evidence as being almost a very much close in time to the events. We're going to be talking about events tens or even hundreds of millions of years in the past and trying to project into the future, our future. So what are the probable causes and how can we identify the correct one? There are any number of possible factors that could contribute to this, and we want to identify which is the most relevant. And this then becomes an exercise in really fully exploiting the scientific method. We want to have a number of competing conjectures. We want the more the merrier. The more you can think of, the more likely you're going to find one that works. And what works means is that you're able to carry out an investigation to assess whether, in fact, it does satisfy everything you've observed and can make predictions. So proceeding from there, what does this have to do with computers? The most probable factor that comes into this has to do with the dynamics, the motion of the planets around the Sun, but also the motion of materials in the outer solar system. So think of comets. Think of some materials that are like asteroids, rocky worlds that are at great distance. And their motion is governed by Newton's laws of physics. And With computers and advanced methodologies, we can proceed to calculate with remarkable precision the evolution of our cosmos in a local sense over hundreds of millions of years. And so these kind of questions do relate very much to the Earth's origin and the evolution of our planet over a long period of time. So the two fundamental aspects of the talk in many regards pertains to the computer application of the laws of physics to identify what happens. So we're going to perform computer-based investigations, look at the orbits of materials that are in the outer solar system, and how they're influenced by the orbits of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And then, once we see the pattern, we want to go back to use advanced theory from physics to explain why it happens and how often it happens. And there are a number of mysteries that emerge en route. So proceeding therein, here's a photo taken from a Russian dash cam. They're very popular in that country. Taken on February 15th, 4 years ago. The Chelyabinsk meteor, which actually did make contact with the surface, it caused some surface damage. It was relatively small, about 20 meters in diameter. In contrast with that, the meteor, or bolide as it's sometimes called, which we associate with the destruction of perhaps as much as 80% of all species on land and in the oceans, especially in the upper levels, 65 million years ago, that was the size of Manhattan. So 20 meters is puny, thankfully. And we can be hit by any number of those. And remember, 70% of the Earth's surface is associated with the oceans. Okay, now that the fire has receded, these events, rarely filmed, do occur, and in fact, we continue to accrete substantial amounts of material from cosmic origins every day. But it's a large events, much larger than this, tens of hundreds of meters. Or how many of you have visited Meteor Crater in Arizona? I would expect most everyone. That meteor was only a few hundred meters across. And other meteorites, I mentioned the one associated with the event 65 million years ago. We have found the crater at the bottom of the Caribbean, and just off the coast of Yucatan, which we've been able to explore at some measure, and that is one of the larger ones. So that's one of the five that really had major impacts, if I use that word, in Earth history. Yes? It's not floating. It's flying at 20 kilometers per second.
So it's as a reminder, make sure that if you have a question, raise your hand and so we can use a mic.
That works out to 40,000 miles per hour.
One moment with your question. We can't hear you.
Okay. Its motion through the atmosphere, because of friction with air, causes the outer surface of it to be molten, not simply molten, but to be vaporized, and that glows and is very strong. So it's a very tiny object in real terms. 20 meters is less than the length of this room. But traveling through the atmosphere at that pace, the glow associated with ablation, the process of its interaction with the atmosphere via friction, brings its surface to temperatures in excess of 3,000 or 4,000 degrees. Let me mention in passing, this was around 1994. There was a meteorite that came down near Poughkeepsie, was tracked by a colleague of mine, George Wetherill, about whom I'll make some mention later. But it happened, it was very fortuitous. This happened on a Friday night. And what happens in the fall on Friday nights? A lot of folks go to high school football games. And so everyone in football games across the central eastern states and the southern states They're all following the game, their respective games with their video cameras, and they see this light in the sky, and they turn it up and follow it. And so Dr. Wetherill then was able to assemble, because of Eyewitness News carrying this, the trajectory of it, and the one sad outcome of this, although tremendous scientific information was established from that regarding its trajectory, it actually hit the back of a Ford Pinto. So there may be a message there. All right, moving ahead. So I've referred to extinction events. How do we know about them? And I'm trying to depict here. I have several slides that give an impression of this. So literally, we have a timeline going from the present into the past, and the narrative here, which is fairly hard to see from back in the room, relates to the geologic ages. So geologists, when they were pursuing their investigations of rocks and the layers therein, and especially the fossil record, noticed abrupt changes in the nature of the flora and fauna, especially, that existed in different times. And one way of characterizing it here, again, we're going back in time, so green dot, as I pursue it, is moving to the right, moving up to the present. And the vertical scale here is a cartoon representation, if you will, of the number of species that were extant, that were present, that we could detect in the fossil record over time. And you notice abrupt changes. So tremendous disruption in numbers of species. And again, this is a cartoon. The narrative here gives some of that history. And fundamental question is, what does this? What comes back relatively often on a time scale of tens of millions of years? Can we understand how it comes about? Can we prevent this from happening in the future? Because we are imperiled. So yet another representation of this, showing again the dramatic drop in numbers of species at various times in the past. And geologists, Cenozoic, the current period, Mesozoic, middle period, Paleozoic, the ancient period, subdivided 65 million years ago, so-called Cretaceous-Tertiary event, going back to the Triassic-Jurassic event, etc., dramatic reductions in numbers of species. Why? This is the ultimate cold case. We're not talking about digging up evidence from last year. We're talking about 65 million to hundreds of millions of years ago. So consider now possible explanations for this. So we need an explanation that would explain this event having an influence everywhere on the globe, on land and in the sea. So we're considering the constraints to the kind of conjectures we can develop. So whether on the surface or in oceans and lakes and so on. It has to have occurred, as you saw, the precipitous decline in a relatively short period of time. And in some instances, we can actually date the Cretaceous-Tertiary event from 65 million years ago. Our ability to date that event is to within about 1,000 years. The error, the uncertainty in that is only 1 part in 1,000, 1 part in 100,000. It's remarkably good. So possible agencies for causing this, could it be some pandemic of a massive sense? Well, pandemics are relatively selective in the kind of host that they will infect and eliminate. So we can rule that out. Volcanism has been suggested as a possibility, but the problem with volcanism is that the volume of ash and other materials produced by them in the last few hundred million years is relatively limited. So as a case in point, let me just finish this one comment and I'll get to your question. Volcanoes only produce basically only 1% of the quantity of carbon dioxide that we as humans produce by burning fossil fuels. So the next time you hear someone blaming volcanoes, we're it. You have a question.
What about mega volcanoes such as Lake Toba in Indonesia or our own Yellowstone.
Okay. The volume of ash produced and its distribution we have to look at carefully, and the evidence supporting such events is relatively weak. Impact events turn out to be much stronger. And at the same time, there are suggestions, and we see that here also on Mars. Impact events caused major volcanic events. So the Tharsis region, for example. So megavolcanoes have a role, but still much smaller.
The potato famine, which was
Krakatoa, and there are two major volcanic events in the 1800s. They were very modest in relative terms. So the cold winters associated with Krakatoa, and there was 1828, and there was a later event. Significant, they lowered the temperature by several degrees. However, the event from 65 million years ago lowered the temperature by 60 degrees. Yes. It eliminated the greenhouse effect, which keeps us warm. Unfortunately, we're making more of a greenhouse effect, which is keeping us uncomfortably warm. Yes?
I recall reading that Yellowstone and megavolcanoes like Yellowstone, what is now Lake Toba, reduced the temperature by 10 degrees, initiating ice ages.
Okay.
And
the megavolcano associated with Yellowstone, that's about 800,000 years ago, had a substantial global impact, but not on the same scale as the extinction events. If you go to the fossil record, you do not see species in large numbers dying out. That's a critical difference. Volcanism, important, but it doesn't quite make it. So we need something bigger that really affects all continents. So massive meteoritic impact events, not simply by suggesting that they're there, we have found indisputable evidence. The so-called Chicxulub crater off the Yucatan Peninsula, we found, okay, that's a smoking gun, literally, for the event. And these extraterrestrial objects coming to us have compositions that are not exactly the same as composition of Earth materials. So the Chicxulub event, the KT event, carried substantial amounts of a rare earth known as iridium. And if you were to dig down and look at the composition of materials as you dig deeper and deeper, at the 65 million year level, you find a very thin layer of iridium, and it's global. And so the essential effect that took place then was you have a meteor coming down, and not that puny thing we saw in the picture, but it would actually blow a hole through our atmosphere, about 60 miles in diameter, more than that, but it would literally vaporize substantial amount of rock and other materials that would rain out, that would spread out throughout the globe. And with that, that cover, you're injecting that material into the stratosphere 25 or 30 kilometers above the surface. It'll sit up there for a long time. It only takes a year or 2 years to do its damage, but we see evidence of that with volcanism. So illustrations of that in the 1980s, when Mr. Reagan was proposing the Strategic Defense Initiative, and Edward Teller, the director of Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, was saying, we don't have to worry because those fine particles would form the sites around which water molecules would gather and it would literally rain out. Except the volcanic events of that time showed otherwise. So we had nature doing the experiment. But you had a question. It came from our welcome visitor.
Professor Newman, can we...
Yeah,
Professor Newman, can you restate Bill's question? Because we do have a podcast, and I want to make sure our podcast people can hear the question. I know it's kind of annoying, but just make sure that the people listening can actually hear you, which means you need a microphone.
Okay, so the iridium indisputably came from our unexpected visitor. Because when you look at the composition of Earth materials, it's no accident that it's referred to as a rare earth element. Okay, and the fossil record as well corresponds to the radioisotope measurements from the iridium deposits. All of these things come together and click. All right, so we know the cause, but we want to understand the mechanics of it. Because this obviously had a horrible impact, and forgive the pun, many times in the past, and we have to be concerned with our futures. And part of the astronomical folklore that emerged, and this was a hint, a conjecture, was that the existence of massive planets in the outer part of the solar system, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, by virtue of their gravity and the interaction of those planets with such materials, they would either absorb them, literally attract them into their own environments, or ultimately or expel them. And so that was part of folklore, but no one tested it. So the key here is, can you test that conjecture? That's where computers come in. And so George Weatherall, who'd been at UCLA in the 70s, in the late 60s, he passed away some years ago, very distinguished planetary astronomer. He went on to the Carnegie Institution. He was a director of one of its branches in Washington for many years. In 1994, he conducted a set of computer experiments. And by the way, your PCs, et cetera, are literally 10,000 times faster than what he used. And so a point to keep in mind is that given that limitation in speed, he had to use methodologies that were, in many regards, far inferior to what theoretically mathematicians had developed for solving what are differential equations. So he used a scheme developed by the astronomer Opik in the 50s, which could be used to extrapolate and try to estimate the trajectory of a comet over a short duration of time. It was not designed nor invented to work over hundreds of millions of years. So, I say that in defense of what Opik had done, but what George had done was very daring. He said, for the first time, let's explore this by computer. So he initiated what we would call today Monte Carlo simulation. Well, it seemed to show that astronomical intuition was correct. He found that less than 1%, in fact, for the outer planets as presently configured, only a tenth of 1% of material in the outer solar system would make its way into the inner solar system. And that seemed to explain why such collision events are relatively rare. Time scale of many tens of millions of years, which is good for us. But then a number of groups, my own included, using some relatively crude calculations, but in fact, much, much more accurate by factors of nearly a million than what Weatherall had pursued, showed around 15% of such materials make it in. Oh, just a second. We are here having this meeting. We wouldn't be here if 15% of the material made it in and collided. And that's a critical feature. It can't just make it into the inner solar system and cross our orbit. It has to hit us. And so we hear all the time about near misses, and we want to understand what's happening. So I draw your attention only to the existence of this table I have below. The relevant point is that my colleagues, Dr. Sharp and Bills and I, undertook a massive computer investigation of this, and we discovered that while at 15% of such material would make it into the inner solar system, only one object in 100,000 would hit us. That's good news. Very good news indeed. So this table looks at the different simulations done we had performed. So that's Newman, Bills, and Sharp. Grazer is a former student of mine, was at JPL for many years. George Wetherill, of course, Horner and Jones in Britain. So this has been an evolutionary process. Science works that way. You have a conjecture, you keep pushing it. You look harder and harder. Oops. So we made our algorithms much more accurate than those employed before. In fact, for most of our calculation, we could guarantee 11 decimal place accuracy. Well, if you're worried about being hit by something or not, it matters. So let me mention in passing, I said we use Newtonian physics. My colleagues at JPL actually apply to spacecraft missions corrections for general and special relativity. And those corrections are one part in 10 million. So they really worry. So moving beyond that. So we introduced not only much better methodologies, but we included now specifically the gravitational influence of Earth and Mars. We've calculated their orbits in concert with the orbits of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. So we were looking for actual impacts. You know, the Earth has a radius of around 4,000 miles, 6,400 kilometers. We would test to see if one of these objects came within 6,400 kilometers of the center of the Earth. If we did, bad news. If it didn't, good news. So we were explicitly looking for that. We were careful to do that. And so I will have to digress a little bit and explain how we were able to pursue this and why the gas giants or the Jovian planets are important. So we added the two terrestrial planets into our orbit computation, 11-digit accuracy. We didn't bother with Venus or Mercury in our calculation in a direct way. They were added in a relatively simple fashion because our concern was, the notion was that planets interior to our orbit would have very little influence in materials that only make it in to our distance. And if such objects went much further in, there was a much higher likelihood that they would strike Earth or Mars first. So this actually saved us a factor of 10 in time. Our computer simulations for some of these calculations took as much as 6 weeks. That's running full time. So multiplying that by 10, we're talking about year-long calculations. First, we confirmed that 15% figure of materials originating in the outer solar system are deflected into the inner solar system and cross our orbit. So that magic number we're worried about. 15%, but happily we don't get hit often. So we want to understand that. And explicitly we saw, only 1 in 10 to the 5, 1 in 100,000 will collide with Earth or Mars. Over 100 million years. Some of our calculations, we went to 500 million years. We had as many as 500,000 test particles in our simulation. These are extremely extensive. And so the fundamental question that emerges is, given the large likelihood, significant likelihood, 15% of materials making their way into the inner solar system, why have we been so fortunate in experiencing so few collisions? Was Wetherill correct? But for unexpected reasons. So he made a prediction. His methods were flawed, but he may have been right. So I have to bring to your attention a couple things that are come into this. This, just for a moment, I think all of you might remember back from grade school. You probably did performed a construction where you took some heavy paper, a couple thumbtacks, and a pencil, and a string, and you would trace out the figure of an ellipse. In 1609, Johann Kepler, and this is an amazing insight, identified that the orbits of the planets, this is before Galileo, a year later, turned the newly invented telescope to the heavens. He, using naked eye observations, using very crude instruments, was able to establish that the planets move around the sun in ellipses. And that was an amazing advance, because in the perspective we had from Ptolemy at the time of the Greeks, we literally believed that the Earth is the center of the universe, and the sun would rotate around us, and the planets were doing a mystical dance in the cosmos. And he showed otherwise, that a much simpler picture emerged from this kind of schoolchild construction. But what I want to bring to your attention is that when you think of an ellipse, you think of its overall length and its width. And there's another way to do this that has a geometrical basis, and I'll just mention that in passing. Because it turns out it involves, I apologize for the formula, but just that you notice that we have a quantity A, which is a distance, and it relates closely, directly to the amount of energy an object has. And so the less energy it has, the more likely it is to be traveling closer to the sun. That's why it's important. And the other aspect of it is this object E, the eccentricity, which tells us how distorted an ellipse is from an ideal circle. If the eccentricity was zero, it would be a perfect circle. If it was one, you've got a parabola and the thing's going to escape. But it relates to the amount of the eccentricity relates in physical terms to the amount of energy present in the motion going around the sun versus the amount of energy involved in the distance from the sun changing in time. So I'm going to skip all the algebra. But what matters, what matters here, just give you a feeling for it. I just chose an eccentricity of a half. Comets typically have an eccentricity of around 0.95, very eccentric orbits. And a feature of that, which is very relevant to us, is comets. How many of you saw in 1986 Halley's Comet? Barely, yes. It looked more like a smudge. Yeah, it was a fuzzball. I remember being at a party in Malibu with another astronomical colleague, and they were asking us to point out to them what we were referring to as the Halley smudge and the Andromeda smudge. So that was all we could see. But the relevant point is that in its 76-year orbit, it spends only a few months in the inner solar system. The overwhelming part of its journey is carried out well beyond the orbit of Jupiter. And that's part of the mystery that we're looking at. So let's look at this further. So we have this data set we produced from months of simulations. So we use data mining to look for pattern. Now, computer can't look for pattern. Humans have to look for pattern. And humans have to teach the computer what to look for. And that's key. So we were trying everything we could think of, and then we found some unexpected pattern that with two primary features. First, the so-called semi-major axis, which relates to the energy of an orbiting particle, would substantially be reduced over time. So if you have planetesimal material, consider between the orbits of Jupiter and Saturn, as time passed, it would be drawn closer and closer to the sun. Why? Because in Kepler's picture, which included only the sun, there was no interaction with planets, etc. What is going on that makes this happen? And two, just as the proximity to the sun would be enhanced, the eccentricity of the orbit would become increased, which would guarantee that planetesimals, which otherwise began with relatively circular orbits, would become extremely eccentric in their trajectory and spend almost all of their time in the outer solar system. Why that matters is if they're spending 99% of their time in the outer solar system, that's where they're going to be eliminated by the outer planets. And happily, not by us. Yes?
Yes, what is the difference, or what does an inner become an outer solar system?
Okay. That's actually a superb question. We make
Can we restate the question?
Yes. What distinguishes the inner from the outer solar system? And at the process of formation of the solar system, each of the objects that went on to become planets formed by a process wherein solid materials that were present accreted and enveloped themselves with the overwhelming amount of material in the solar system was basically hydrogen and helium following the Big Bang. And Jupiter and Saturn, by virtue of the size we developed, were obviously the first on the block, the first to form. Inside their orbits, what we see today is Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, were much smaller and much closer to the Sun. And why that mattered is in the very early times, the Sun, in trying to establish its ability to burn by nuclear processes fuel, flared up dramatically. You think of solar flares and the like. At that time, in the very early phase, be literally thousands of times more powerful than we see today. And it blew off our primitive atmosphere. The atmosphere we breathe today is actually a tertiary one. After the blow-off of that hydrogen and helium atmosphere we once had, from the interior of the Earth, carbon and oxygen were released through volcanism, etc. Carbon dioxide and water were the dominant components. And then around 4.4 billion years ago, 4.6 billion years ago, is the best evidence we have for when the Earth basically formed. And you can't put a date on it. It's a process. And it's one that went on for half a billion years. But 4.4 billion years ago, there was a massive impact event. An object the size of Mars struck Earth. And by that time, the Earth had cooled sufficiently in its interior that the heavier materials, the metals, sank into the very center, producing the core, and the lighter materials, ordinary rocks, enveloped it, forming a mantle. That collision event stripped a significant chunk of material in the mantle, which went off. Some of it came back. This is very violent collision. It's just breaking up everything. A bigger part? Yes? So it was a very violent event. It has been simulated by colleagues in Arizona with supercomputer codes. We have a good little picture of that using fundamental first principles physics. So some of the material didn't have speed enough to escape. Some escaped, some fell back, and some went into orbit. And the stuff that orbited collected together and formed our moon. So the evidence for that is quite good, but it's complicated because the moon and the Earth continue to accrete material around it. So you'll find materials on the surface of the moon that are, in fact, older than some parts of the Earth. That's just because we continue to collect stuff. All right. So supermassive collision events. So the issue that I was trying to address here was in our data mining, and I want to show you an image that describes this. This so-called semi-major axis, which is a kind of measure of distance, how close we get to the Sun, or rather one of the an orbiting planetesimal, comet, asteroid, etc., undergoes a systematic change, a reduction, is getting closer to the Sun. And meanwhile, the eccentricity goes up. So I'm going to show you two panels here, and let me try to explain this figure. And the reason I'm doing this is I don't want to simply say, well, skipping all the details, I want to try to convince you we have absolute evidence. This is something that passes muster when reviewed by in peer review processes, by other scientists, etc. It's not one opinion versus another. We have the evidence to back it up. And so in this image, what we're showing at the horizontal is distance from the sun measured in units that are commensurate with what the Earth is doing. So the Earth would be one. We're number one. Okay. So Jupiter is at 5.2. Saturn is at 9, roughly. And so all the points, looking at where they are at the horizontal, are between, initially, Jupiter and Saturn. But you notice something rather bizarre. What I choose to show in the vertical is how close the objects are, what the semi-major axis is, when it actually crosses the orbit of Earth. So this could be some thousands of years or many millions of years in its evolution. But you see this amazing pattern. Everybody is closer. It's a systematic effect. So this is telling us, hey, we see a clue. We want to figure out why. And another comment here relevant to that. In this simulation, we had we had 10,000 planetesimals. And in this figure, which shows only the ones that went on to cross the Earth's orbit, 1,546. Well, guess what? 15%. But what is the fate of them? I do the similar thing in this right-hand panel looking at eccentricity, how distorted from a circle the orbit is. And the relevant point is that we could have relatively high, low to high eccentricities initially, but essentially everyone ends up having a much higher eccentricity. So the picture I described earlier holds. This is our computational evidence. So we understand what happened. We want to understand why. And so I'm going to just go through this very quickly. So the bottom line, literally, why do we have systematic drops in a semi-major axis and a jump in eccentricity? Why? Why is my... finally. I'm going to show you a picture. Did I miss a slide? Okay. Okay. So Kepler's picture from 1609, we've made some progress since then, was that looking at an object orbiting the sun with no external influence from other planets. Jupiter has only a tenth of 1% of the mass of the sun, but nevertheless has a strong influence on the motion of the planets. How many of you remember this is almost 40 years ago? Scary. No, 35 years ago, the Jupiter effect. People were worried that Jupiter and Saturn were all lining up, etc. And it turns out it's rubbish here. But if you're out there, it's a big deal. So in the early 1800s, people... such as Hamilton in Britain, Jacobi in Germany, Tisson and Poincaré in France, came to appreciate that we really need to expand our horizon and think of such materials orbiting the sun, but also under the influence, especially of Jupiter. 300 times more massive than we are. You can't ignore it. And so I'm going to show you a picture which provides an indication of why that can be important. And here in this image, okay, the sun is at the crosshairs, here's Jupiter, and these circles designate for material in the inner solar system, which was stripped of its original atmospheres. Jupiter and the giant planets were sufficiently far away and big enough with sufficient gravity that they were able to hang on to it. So inner solar system, depleted of the original atmosphere, outer solar system, kept it. I mentioned carbon dioxide and water then became our atmosphere from outgassing from the Earth's interior, volcanism, etc. The great impact event, the giant impact event, eliminated our secondary atmosphere, And much of what we're breathing today actually is we're the beneficiary of impact events, comets, etc., over hundreds of millions of years, as well as outgassing from the interior. Okay, and we know this looking at the composition of the atmospheric gases, cometary materials, and so on. All right, so this picture, this is an indication of the combined gravitational influence of the Sun and Jupiter. And so you see close to the Sun, so Jupiter is significant, but it's still puny compared to the Sun. It doesn't do much to distort these circles. But you get out to its distance from the Sun, and you notice there are these funny islands that form. So some of you may be science fiction fans. So Lagrange points and L5, establishing colonies, etc. Anyone? Okay. Well, it's a great place, but we won't go there. We do use this kind of these issues when we send a spacecraft to Jupiter or Saturn. Currently, our rocket boosters, which are much smaller than the ones used, I hate saying it, 50 years ago, which we can no longer reproduce, the dyes for building them are gone, and so on. Yeah, we don't have enough horsepower, so to speak, to get there. So what do? Well, if you imagine we're out here, and let's imagine it said, here's the Sun, here's Venus, we shoot, instead of trying to go way out here in the outer solar system, we actually send our spacecraft to the vicinity of Venus, and it'll get a kick from Venus and get shot out. So that's what we do, and since we don't have a filling station, we can stop at en route. Okay, so the importance of this is Jupiter really does have a massive influence, and the combination of Jupiter and the Sun is what has to be determined. So what I'm going to say now, okay, here's Félice François Tisserand. He was a snazzy dresser, but important point is he gave us a formula, which you can instantly forget. But the take-home lesson from this is that by looking at the combined influence of Jupiter and the Sun, he recognized that the semi-major axis A and the eccentricity E weren't constant, but they were connected to each other. You could have a shift in one produce a shift in the other. And the whole idea is then exchanging energy between the motion in the distance away from the Sun as opposed to around the Sun. And it provided a linkage for that. Well, I know you can't see this, but I wanted to simply point out its existence. This is from volume 4, page 205 of his Traité de Mécanique Céleste. Yes, and I had to read 3.5 volumes to find this. So it's beautiful French, but leaving it at that. What this lists here, basically all the comets known, and he was the director at the time of the Observatoire de Paris, all the comets known at that time, and he basically used the formula he invented to see, does this fit with an object whose origin was closely influenced by Jupiter? And the answer was yes. And so, since it proved to be so successful in looking at real objects in our solar system, we decided we're going to apply the same standard to our simulations. All that I want to point out here, you see, these are data points from our simulation, and they fit the formula magnificently, except for a couple oddballs. And those oddballs, out of 1,546, those oddballs seem to be under the influence of Saturn. So could Saturn be playing a role? Can we understand that? So Saturn behaves as though it's an external shepherd, and I want to explain that. So it's a concept familiar to us from planetary ring dynamics. How many of you have followed, until its demise in the last couple months, the Cassini spacecraft in its exploration of Saturn? So you've seen some of those amazing images. But I'm going to show you some images in a moment, emergent from Saturn, from previous missions, that will describe this phenomenon of shepherding. And so here's our cartoon I put together. It's the simplest one I could construct. Okay, we have the Sun, big yellow ball, okay, Jupiter, Saturn. This, in fact, is representative of the difference in size. But suppose you have a planetesimal, some cometary material, whatever, between the orbit of Jupiter and Saturn. And that's what we started off with in our computer investigation. But you notice, at this moment in time, that planetesimal is closer to Saturn than it is to Jupiter. So while Jupiter is more than three times as large, at that moment, Saturn is going to have a prominent influence. And so the idea then we had was, okay, is something happening when it happens a planetesimal, any one of those objects is closer to Saturn than to Jupiter? And instantly, knowing the physics of planetary rings, so I want to show you some images, we believed that our conjecture then became, so you see this evolutionary process. Everything we discover leads us to another prediction, another thing to check, and that makes an airtight case. Some images, just a reminder of what our solar system, outer solar system looks at. The inner solar system is lost in the central core. Here's Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Oh, and Pluto, this picture makes clear why we don't consider it to be a planet. The word planet comes from Greek word planete, which means a wanderer in the sky. But all the planets formed from the same process that produced the Sun, except Pluto. And it's literally in a plane on its own. It's the plane it's in is 30 degrees off from the plane of all the planets. So it wasn't there originally. It's a visitor that stayed. So a couple images here. So if we go to a picture of the rings of Saturn, here I'll give you an illustration. Here's a picture of the rings of Saturn. And you see these gaps. Here's the so-called F ring. And I'm afraid planetary astronomers are kind of boring when it comes to naming things. You know, you have the A ring, you have the B ring, you have, okay, never mind, you got the picture. So here you have the moon Prometheus. Here you have the moon Pandora. And here you have particles. What's happening is that Prometheus, by being closer to the center of Saturn than these ring particles, actually pushes away the particles in the ring, while Pandora, being further out, still pushes them in. So that's what I was trying to convey in this image. It's a little unclear, given the size of the room, but if this is a moon, and here's a ring particle, if you're inside, you're pushed in. If you're outside, you're pushed out. So let me just segue back to this. When a planetesimal is closer to Saturn than to Jupiter, so the three-body picture involving the Sun and Jupiter is no longer adequate, what's going to happen? Saturn is going to push it in. And that'll cause its semi-major axis, A, to become smaller in every single instance. Okay, so back to here another illustration, an absolutely gorgeous one, of the F ring flanked by Pandora. And there are 23 identified rings. I always forget all their names, but it's family connections are limited here. So Prometheus and Pandora, but you see just how delicate the structure is. It's as though it causes them to focus between the two. If Prometheus were somehow eliminated, they would be all driven in. So you see instances in the ring structure, very delicate, gossamer filigree kind of construct emerging from many, many moons. All right. So we're proposing now, this is a conjecture, a mechanism that would explain why the semi-major axis always decreases, and that's due to Saturn. What can you do then? You test it. We have this massive amount of data. And so here's one particle, We reproduce this figure many, many times, and this shows two things on the same timeline. This is approximately 55,000 years after the simulation was initiated. That is in planetary years, not in our computer time. And so the red line is that so-called constant, the Jacobi constant associated with Tisserand. You expect it to be around 2.8 or so. And you see it's flatliner, except it undergoes these little blips. What's causing those blips? Something is going on. So the blue line, which I plot on top of this, shows the distance to of a planetesimal to Saturn minus the distance to Jupiter. So if you're closer to Saturn than you are to Jupiter, your blue line will be negative. You'll be in negative territory. And you notice when you are closer to Saturn than to Jupiter, that's when you see a characteristic change in that constant. And the picture now we have is complete. Question? Okay. All right. So, you know, we started off looking at this conjecture that Wetherill, using very approximate methods, came up with 99.9% of such materials would be shielded from the inner solar system, and discovered 15% of it would actually come in. But we're still carrying on with this conversation. So we were very fortunate. We did the very accurate computer simulations. And so as computer aficionados, I expect you would appreciate that. And we found from those investigations that only 1 in 100,000 would make it in and actually hit us, which is good news. But then the heavy lifting came when we had to understand why. And so applying astrophysical theory, celestial mechanics, etc., and those tools, and a lot of data mining, the picture became crystal clear. So take-home message today is that science operates by developing different conjectures to try to explain observed phenomena. You advance a proposal, you test it, you try to make projections, predictions, you go the next step, and it's a process of iteration, of refinement. And so we today have a much deeper understanding of these issues than we had only a couple decades ago. And so the good news is, vis-a-vis impact events, the Near-Earth Asteroid Program, which was funded via NASA, but through actually the Defense Department, very much concerned about these issues. And so for the next 30 years, you have nothing big to worry about. Thereafter, the catalogs that exist of such objects continue to grow. We're able to monitor it much better as time passes. And as time passes also, we will develop the wherewithal, should we need to deflect such objects. And no, forget the blockbuster disaster movies. You don't want to break up one of these things with a nuclear device. All you would be doing is showering the Earth in radioactive isotopes with objects that will definitely come in. Not good. So, summary slide. Okay, the three-body description, which had been so successful for a century, the 19th century, was very helpful. Close approaches by planetesimal to Saturn causes the orbit to become more tightly bound, but at the same time, it causes also the eccentricity to increase. And so we actually have to look at a four-body problem where Saturn, in addition to Jupiter, has an important role and gives us some insight here. So discussion and conclusions. Okay, basically I've already encapsulated that in my previous remarks. But I hope as well providing this presentation, it's given you a perspective on how science is performed. You have an observation. You're motivated. Why? How does this come to be? What's going on? You don't simply accept one idea over another. It's not a matter of my opinion and all opinions are equal. No, they are not. In the end, it's the evidence you collect. And that is what matters. So I think that's a... I have one last slide. In fact, one outcome of this research, there had been a proposal well over a decade ago by a French group at Observatoire de Nice. It's often referred to as the Nice model, that there was an epoch of time when the inner solar system underwent an incredibly intense and short-lived period of bombardment, late heavy bombardment was called. And my colleagues at UCLA, Mark Harrison, and at that time his PhD student, Patrick Behnke, looking very, very carefully at the meteoritic record, isotope records, cratering records, etc., found no evidence whatsoever for that conjecture. And the mechanism I've provided here makes it clear why it happens. Jupiter and Saturn were first on the scene. They prevented that stuff from coming in and making an absolute mess of the early solar system about 4 billion years ago.
So we can breathe easier?
Yes, please. I would encourage it.